I'm Dan Smith. I'm the Deputy CIO at Marquette University. I'm also the head of our project management office. And Aaron?
My name's Aaron Ott. I'm a Windows administrator at Marquette, and I kind of handle the behind-the-scenes stuff, like the upgrade implementation of this.
And one of my roles, I'm also the project server administrator, so I do the more of the functional configuration and setup, and Aaron does the heavy lifting technical stuff. So that's how can we separate things. So we have a number of slides to go through, but it's such a small group. Let's just make this more interactive. If we're not talking about something you want to hear about, we're more than willing to change that. I'm also using, for the first time in a live presentation, a little device for my Windows phone to control the PowerPoint. So if this stops working at any time, you'll see us running up to touch the keys. So we're going to talk a little bit about where we started, how we use Project Server, or why we wanted to upgrade to 2013. Aaron then is going to touch on the technical upgrade itself, what functional improvements we saw, how we're using... Wow, that hurts.
Me?
I don't know, I didn't move. How we're using workflow and the issues and challenges we still have in our environment. So a little bit about Marquette, about 11,000 students, 2,500 faculty staff. We're a central IT, and so we have about 80 FTE, but we're all so small where we're all wearing multiple hats. We do have 6 full-time PMs that report up to the project management office, up to me. We have standardized on Project Server 2013. One of the interesting stats is about 15% of our projects that we manage are hardcore technical projects. The other 85% are university-wide technically related projects. We started way back in the days of Project Center. I don't know if anybody in this room actually remembers that. We then upgraded to Project Server 2007. But in 2007, as you probably know, we only had our... I wasn't even moving. Maybe you're in front of that speaker. I wonder if that's doing it. We only had our in-progress projects in Project Server 2007, so I had a separate access database to control all the other projects that were in the queue and that sort of stuff. In Project Server 2010, the big advantage we got was all the projects and all the information were in Project Server, so all that access database information we pulled in the Project Server. That was really key for us. So one of my favorite quotes, which I use routinely with my project managers, is hope is not a strategy. I really love that saying, so if they come up and say, I really hope to be done in 3 months, prove to me why you're going to be done in 3 months. Don't just hope you're going to get done. So that means our project management requires a defined process. We're tracking against schedule, but you know that's necessary, but it's not the complete picture. And communication, obviously, is the number one success factor that we've seen in our project management stuff. We make really good use of Project Server. So we have templates for the project plan and the budget. We use Project Server to standardize what we do. We do project management training both in-house and external. So we try to do maybe once a year to bring somebody in to sit down and do formal training for us. And then all the PMs meet every other week to just to make sure we're doing things the same way, the right way, and we're all doing things alike. So when people float from team to team, they really can not have to start over with how we do projects. Sure. We're just now getting ready to put those in production. So yes, we have one for security. So we put up new security systems for a room, like card swipes and physical access, that sort of stuff. We have one for audio visual. When we put that in a classroom, we have a template for that. And then we're going to have what's the other one, Kurt? You remember? There's one more. That was physical security. And then we're going to have a generic project management template, software upgrade, that sort of thing. One thing we don't do at Marquette is we don't develop in-house. We mainly buy off the shelf and customize and implement. So we don't do agile. We're more waterfall-based stuff. We are in the middle of an Oracle e-business suite upgrade. We use Oracle Financials, and that's been a multi-year, multi-million dollar project, and it's killing us in some ways. We generate a budget, it's submitted to finance for approval, and then we're tracking actuals against the budget, and we're also forecasting out in the out months for how that project work cash flow is going to look. And we'll talk about that a little bit when we get the UMT product. That's kind of what that brought to the table. We also incentivize our PMs to get their PMP, so they get a salary bump when that happens. It's something. And we also pay for them to go to the course. Just kind of level set, when we talk about a project plan, it was a formal document approved. And that was really more back in the 2007 days. Now we're using Project Server to house all that information. So the need for a Word document has kind of gone by the wayside. And then when we talk about a schedule, that's the typical project MPP sort of file, all that kind of stuff. So this is the elements of a plan. I'm not going to bore you with all this. You can see what's in that plan. But some of the things we do in Project Server now that used to be in this Word doc is the communication plan's all in Project Server. The project tracking plan is all in Project Server. The project scope and objectives is all in Project Server. So all that stuff now we've moved from separate documents inside Project Server or to the associated project websites as we do this. So just a couple of highlights. Views make the list very powerful in our opinion. So you can set up a view of your projects to say only show me projects that are in the managed stage, or only show me a list of issues that are active and open, or only show me a list of issues that we need steering committee approval on. And so, you know, when you go into a steering committee meeting and you throw up a bunch of issues, often they get distracted and they want to look at this one over here that maybe they don't really need to approve, but maybe more interesting for some reason. So we want to limit their focus of what they're looking at, because after all, they're high-level executives and they get easily confused. So we want to make sure they're limited in what they can look at. That was a joke if this is being recorded. So we make great use of lists. Issues, risks are out of the box, but we have communication plans and change orders that we've generated on our custom templates that put out there as well. And those are also heavily used. One of the reasons we wanted Project Server in the first place is we wanted better resource management. What we discovered is that you got to be fairly mature in your processes for that to happen. You all have to be scheduling similarly. You all have to be estimating in a similar basis. And it really takes a while to get your project managers up to that same level. But what we got right away is these project workspaces. That was a big win for us in the collaborating area. They've talked about that at the conference here a little bit. But the collaboration that provides really has been very, very beneficial for us. As a matter of fact, our mantra is for do not send attachments. Send links to documents you want somebody to edit. Send links to the issues list that you want them to update. Don't send documents in email. So we're trying to really get away from who's got the latest version of this. If it's out on the project site, you know that's the latest version. We got versioning control on. We have all the features that we can use out there on the project site. And with 2013, you can have multiple people editing the same Word document at the same time. You have the web services. So you don't have to have a PC to get in to see an Excel file. If you don't have Excel installed, you can use the web app. So very powerful stuff for us. So this is what we expect our project managers to do. Project schedule developed, resources assigned, published out. Project schedule updated at least weekly. Documents associated with Project Server posted out. Issues and risks posted out. And then we still do weekly status reports via email. We haven't really found a good mechanism yet for how we can do that more automatically. So this is what a project workspace looks like. You can see the new timeline feature in the workspace along the left-hand side, notebook documents, PM files. And PM files is just a document library where it's maybe have some more sensitive information that only the project manager should see. Especially if we have vendors coming into our sites, we don't want them to see the competitive bid process maybe or something like that, so we may stash it in there and restrict permissions on it. And then the list over there, risk, issues, decisions, another list we made after the VP of finance after a particular project said, well, who the hell made that decision? And we said, well, we don't remember. And so we've now started tracking major decisions that were made through the life of the project. Change orders we talked about and communication plan we talked about. Is everybody familiar with the notebook, new in Project Server and SharePoint 2013? Anybody use OneNote? You like it? Yeah. Love it. We use it all the time. So OneNote is a web app notebook. And so you can open that up, and you can view your OneNote in the browser. And you can also open it in the thick client for editing. And so that has taken the place of, you know, SharePoint used to have meeting workspaces. Those were deprecated in the 2013 version, and they've replaced it with notebook. And so now we set up a series of reoccurring meetings, for example, for steering committee or project team meetings. You can have that notebook, and when you send out your meeting invite, the link is automatically included in the meeting invite, and it will populate, you know, the date of the meeting as you set it up. So it's really a really nice feature, and we make heavy use of that as well. It took us a while to wrestle this one down a little bit. So what do you folks call an issue? Pardon? Realized risk, okay. Anything else? We kind of make it anything that's going to stop forward movement of the project, right? So if you have a decision that needs to be made, if something bad happens, the classical definition of issue, that's an issue for us. So a problem, a decision that needs to be made, a question that needs to be answered, those are all issues, and those are all the things we log out on our project site. When do we need to log it? We had that question. So we said, well, if it's going to be open for greater than one business day, or if it's cross-functional, so if you're going to hand it off to somebody resolved, then you have to log it. It's surprising, at least to me it was at the time, how hard it was to come up with that sort of stuff. But people were asking the question, and we really had to codify this across the whole PMO to make sure people were doing this the same way. The other thing that was a little bit of rocket science for us is status. Those are all out of the box. Category, went on the websites and did a little research and came up with those, not too clever. Priority was our hardest thing to get our heads around. I mean, it seems obvious that you have a high, medium, and low. I think that's out of the box, right? So we have a blocking issue we've added, and then a post-project issue. Once we realized that a priority of an issue could change out throughout the life of the issue, so what may be a blocking issue today could be a high priority tomorrow or vice versa, or maybe what would be a low priority issue today could be a post-project issue. Once we figured out you could change the priority of an issue, then that all kind of fell into place. So how we use blocking issues is we use that's going to prohibit us from going to that next thing, whatever that next thing is, whether it's go live or whether it's the next phase of the project or whatever the case may be. So all the blocking issues have to be resolved before we make that transition. And they can be resolved by actually resolving them, or they can be resolved by reclassifying them as a high, medium, or low. And so when we get ready to go live, for example, we can't have any blocking issues out there. Post-project is just what it says. If we classify something as a post-project issue, that means we're not going to spend any time or effort on that issue. When we get the project closed, when we turn it over to operations, we give them a list of those things and says, here you go. Go have fun with these. There's something for you to do with this project. The closure is another custom field we added. Is who can approve the closure? In other words, if whoever's working the issue says, yeah, I fixed it, who agrees that, yep, it's fixed the way it should be fixed? Is it the project team? Is it the project manager? Is it the PM working group or the steering committee? And that's kind of the hierarchy of our governance for project management. And so that's just a check to say if it's a high-level, maybe policy issue, the steering committee will want to agree that, yes, that was resolved the way it should be resolved. And that's what we use that field for. So here's a snapshot of our Oracle project as of a couple weeks ago, probably. But you see, for this particular multiple assignments for students, we were putting in a system in Oracle where students were going to use the new timekeeping system. And they worked multiple jobs on campus at the same time, so we had to have multiple assignments. But at the time we took this, you can see we had 8 blocking issues, 10 high issues, 10 medium issues, and 1 low. And you look across all the different things we're deploying, and the way the project manager has these set up is by Oracle module. He's got it grouped by Oracle module so they can focus on them that way. You can see that one had 29 issues. ACH payments only had 1. The budgeting system improvements had 33. And then in production, they have 57 issues. So you can see that we make really heavy use of this issues list, and when we send out our updates, we don't send a list of high-level issues, we send a link to the issues list because it changes so dynamically. We don't want to put something that's static out there. So three years ago, finance came to us and said, we want a projects database because people keep submitting these projects to us. They will sometimes not resubmit the project, or they would not, they'd submit a slightly different project the following year. We need projects, the project rationale, the business case, if you will, in a common format. We need budgets in a consistent format. And oh, by the way, something you've never done before, we want you to start forecasting your projects. In other words, we're not satisfied that it's going to be a $50,000 project or a $2 million project. We want to see a month-by-month forecast of those project costs over the life of the project. And so we said, oh, that's interesting. How are we going to do this? Well, we knew Project Server could do the first two items for us, but then we went out and started searching for something that would help us do the budgets and the budget forecasting, and we came across UMT's product. It's UMT 360, as it's branded today. Back then, I think it was Project Financial Server, and when we first implemented, it's gone through several iterations. And that allows us to capture budget information without having a detailed project schedule. So we could just have a one-line schedule and then capture all the budget information we want along with that project. And that's what then the finance office can and the budget office can go and approve. So the two major initiatives were collect all this project information in a common format, retain historical information, document approval of the projects as well, and then the reporting we could get out of it. And then the longer term is provide for a more visible and transparent selection process. And I'm happy to say that this year, for the first time, we actually used a portfolio tool inside Project Server to support the entire capital selection process for the university. So that was a lot of fun to finally see that come around. So I think I've talked about all this except maybe tracking, tracking of actuals. Right now, we're kind of doing double entry. So when we get an invoice in coming in that needs to be paid, we hand key that in to Project Server. We then pass it to our business manager who enters it into Oracle Financials and actually cuts the check or whatever to go pay the people that need to be paid. We are working towards an interface to pull those stuff into Project Server so we don't have to hand enter it. But frankly, it's been kind of nice to be able to compare the two systems and make sure that we're not getting cheated somehow by finance. Not that that would ever happen, but we'd like to be able to check it. So now we're going to be talking to let Aaron talk a little bit.
I'm going to turn this on. Sorry, Frederick, you're here.
Yeah.
All right. So for anybody who came in after Dan started, my name's Aaron Ott. I'm the Windows Administrator at Marquette University. I've actually been there about 7 or 8 years now, and I first started, I think my first project was working with Project Server 2007. So since then, I've done a lot of Project Server upgrades and SharePoint upgrades. And what I'm just going to do is kind of like a high-level, slightly meandering overview of our process, how we went through it. It's not going to be too technical, but if anybody does have any questions they want to throw out at me during this, feel free to shout those out. So yeah, we had a variety of reasons, you know, we wanted to upgrade to 2013 from 2010. One of those is improved performance for us. Queue processes were a lot speedier now, and Active Directory sync has been improved. And then if you're in the keynote the other day, they talked about percentages of how fast things were in 2013 compared to 2010. So Microsoft made a lot of improvements on how fast Project Web App and all the other project services are now. Browser support was a big one for us. No longer are people tied to IE. You know, now they can use Chrome and Firefox, and then it really helps if you're a Mac user. You can use whatever browser you want on Macs to access Project Web Access and pretty much do everything I think a team member or a project manager needs to do if you don't need the client. workflow has seen a lot of changes from 2010 to 2013. There's a new architecture for workflow in SharePoint 2013 that Project 2013 uses. And that meant a couple things to us. The big one is that we could design workflow with SharePoint Designer now, which is pretty cool. We have some complicated workflows that Dan will go over a little bit later. when it comes to the UMT part of things, it meant we had to figure out how to migrate workflow that we had created in UMT Project Essentials and bring that back to SharePoint now, which wasn't actually too bad. And then Dan mentioned OneNote. All new project sites, when a project is created, have this link right on the sidebar that says notebook, and that lets you just open up a OneNote notebook. And it kind of, like you said, replaces the meeting workspaces and lets you keep track of everything. And since a lot of people now are using OneNote, it's really nice to have that easily available. The client has seen a lot of speed improvements, and they had some touch improvements in the client. They brought the design in line with the rest of the Office 2013 apps. And then there's a reporting improvement that's there now. You can use basic Power Pivot stuff. That's a big one for project managers and project management team. And then the project timeline stuff that you can sort of see in this screenshot and then some of Dan's things before, but you basically have a nice overview of all the tasks and what your timeline looks like to a project manager and then your team members. And then on the back end, for me and the database guys, there's a bit of database consolidation going on. So they went from 4 project web app databases down to 1, which is pretty cool. And then on the UMT side, they went from 2 to 1. So what that means to the IT guys is that we have fewer databases to worry about backing up, fewer to do maintenance on. And then if we need to do a restore or a refresh to a different environment, it's just a lot easier for us to do that. It's a lot of nice improvements there. So I'll talk a little bit about how our Project Server 2010 environment was, and then I'll go into what we wanted to go to for 2013. When we made this, we had just a single server running all the project apps and acting as a web server. It's kind of the minimal recommended approach from Microsoft, and it worked for us for the most part until we started adding third-party apps onto it. We definitely had to bump the specs up at a later point. And then we wanted to get away from that in Project Server 2013. We had a single SQL server on the back end, and then we ended up installing UMT's Project Financial Server and then upgrading that to Project Essentials, I think, while it was still in Project Server 2010. So our target environment, I wanted to build it out a lot and just make it, make sure performance was going to be a lot better, make sure it could handle any sort of issues that would occur on a single server, and basically move to a more recommended and supported model from Microsoft, which is having multiple servers in your farm. So we went from a single app web server to a variety of servers, so we could have multiple servers running the project service, which leads to improved performance for project managers and team members when they're submitting tasks and stuff. And then we went to multiple servers running the web services, which means everybody trying to go to project web access is going to see reduced load times and just have an overall better experience. And then that little screenshot kind of shows what happens. You can go to each service or on a particular server and stop or start whatever you want on a particular server. So we would have a couple of them that are just running the web services. And then we're also a virtualized environment, so we use Hyper-V. And we virtualize both SQL and Project Server. And part of the upgrade means you go to brand new hardware, so new VMs, and we're able to, through getting better Hyper-V hardware on the back end, we're able to give these virtual machines more CPUs and more memory and just make sure they're really beefy servers. And then we did the same thing for our SQL server on the back end. We virtualized that, but we made sure that the new VM it's going to is going to be really, really powerful and be able to handle all the stuff we're throwing at it. And I know that there are some other sessions that Microsoft talked about how this is recommended, but you have to make sure that your hardware, your VMware or your Hyper-V hosts are powerful enough to do this. And we are, I think, so we virtualized it. And of course, we need the latest Windows OS on all those servers. And we wanted to make sure we had the latest cumulative update for Project Server and SharePoint on these servers. And at the time of our upgrade, I think we were at the August cumulative update. And it's important, I think, to make sure you get these cumulative updates, because from RTM through whatever's out, there's going to be a ton of bug fixes. And then now they recommend at least having the March public update on these things. And it's just a lot easier to be on a cumulative update instead of going live and having one get released immediately and then having to apply it, which is going to take 2 or 3 hours of downtime. And then, of course, our target environment was going to have the new version of UMT's app, which is now called UMT 360. So we had to make sure we had the process for upgrading to that down. And then as a part of that upgrade to 360, we needed to bring all this workflow that we built in the old UMT app back to SharePoint to use SharePoint's built-in native workflow stuff. So the preparation for this, just kind of really quickly, there's a lot of reading that I would do as a Windows admin. TechNet is an invaluable resource. They have guides, you know, exactly what they want you to do these upgrades, and everything they need, they want you to know, all your upgrade prep and all your post-upgrade stuff. A lot of really good blogs. Brian Smith is one of the presenters here, and he runs an awesome project blog. I think he runs the official project blog and his own, and he's a great resource because he always makes people aware of the CUs that are coming, and then just a bunch of other tips for IT people and for project managers, team members. Since we're a virtual environment, we get to throw up a ton of test virtual machines, which is awesome because I can throw up a test VM, install project server on it, break it, you know, get rid of it, do it over again, which is great. And during that process, I make sure to take a lot of notes using OneNote. And as a part of those notes, you need to inventory your environment. So when it comes to project server settings and UMT settings, any custom solutions you have, any custom web parts, if you're using incoming email, you need to make sure to document all of this stuff so that when you go through the upgrade process, you don't want to go live and then be missing a bunch of things that project managers are going to come back to you and say, hey, how come this setting or feature is gone? It used to be in the old environment. So you have to make sure you do a good inventory. And for Windows admins, there's a bunch of tools out there that let you do that. CodePlex is a good resource to find tools like SPFarm inventory, or you just go through your environment and, you know, make a note of everything you're doing. Technically, you should have been noting down everything when you would implement it, but not everyone does that. And so you have your inventory and your notes and your VMs, you do a lot of practice upgrades, and you break everything, you do more practice upgrades, because you'll do an upgrade, something will go wrong, and you'll need to do it again. And of course, you take more notes. And then OneNote. So a couple other ways to prepare that you may be able to get into, depending on, I guess, what level of access you have with Microsoft. We do TAPs and RDPs. So TAPs are technology adoption programs, and RDP is rapid deployment programs. We were involved with the Project Server 2010 TAP and the 2013 TAP. And outside of the project and SharePoint stuff, we also got to do the Exchange ones, Link ones, and then we were involved in Server 2012 and the Server 2012 R2 TAPs and RDPs. And these are awesome because it's basically you're getting early access to the software. So for Project Server 2010 and 2013, we got alpha and beta bits of this stuff. I think we saw it early enough that you know, at first we couldn't even install it on-prem, but we got to take a look at what they're bringing. And then we get these early bits so we can start playing with it in our environment, seeing what the requirements are, and then we can start testing upgrades and seeing how that whole process is going to go. But this is really good. So if you have a technology account manager through Microsoft or any contact at Microsoft, you know, if you want to ask if you have the capability to spin up test VMs and do this stuff, this is a really great program to be involved in. And then use OneNote to track everything, as we mentioned before. And what I like to do is, with all these resources, all these practice upgrades I do, all the social forums and blogs, I like to take Microsoft's upgrade installations and installation instructions and everybody else's and combine it to make my own installation guide and my own upgrade guide. And the only reason I do this is because our environment is not going to be a vanilla environment like Microsoft might be writing their instructions for. And like, we have UMT software installed, so it's already a little different. We have a couple custom add-ins that do a couple of things here and there for us that are different. So it makes the upgrade and the installation just a little bit different. So it helps to create your own documentation. And then once you have that stuff, you basically try to break your stuff. So you start hitting it really hard. You do everything to it that an end user might do to it. You turn off a server, you know, or you turn off a service, and you just see what happens. Because you want to figure out what the weak points in your environment are, and then make sure to kind of fix those so that when you release it to end users after your upgrade, you're not going to run into any crazy surprises. So, of course, we have an upgrade execution plan where this is where you meet with your project team and your project managers and your team members, and you let them know everything they need to know about what's going to happen to the environment. And they really want to know what the upgrade means, right? They want to know what's going on behind the scenes. They want to know what they have to do or what they shouldn't do. And they need to know what's going to happen to their projects and all their data. And specifically, they need to know what happens to Project Web Access 2010. So what's going to happen to the Project Server 2010 environment during this upgrade process? And for our environment, we were kind of fortunate in that we were changing our URL for Project Server. So this allowed us to leave Project Server 2010 up, but in a read-only mode. When we started our upgrade, we switched it to read-only. All the project members, managers, and team members knew that they could still access everything in Project Web App 2010, all their documents and tasks and risks and stuff, but they knew that they couldn't edit or update or change any of that. And that's really good because the upgrade process is going to take, you know, a pretty decent amount of time, so they'll never be without all their project information during that process. And of course, we have to let them know how they're going to get access to the upgraded project environment after it's done. And since we were changing URLs, we let them know that we'll send out that URL after we're done, but not before, because we don't want any of these people accessing this environment maybe after it's sort of up, but not before, say, Dan and I are still tweaking things here and there, and we don't want any changes to occur before it's officially in production. And then before everything happens, I'm a really paranoid Windows admin, so I check everything a million times, and I have a ton of notes, which is why I mentioned notes over and over, and I'll check my target farm and make sure all the services I need started are started, make sure UMT stuff's installed and ready for me, and just make sure everything is the way it's supposed to be to prevent any issues with your upgrade. And then you also have to have a plan in case it all blows up, because there's always a possibility no matter how much preparation you do. And in our case, our backup plan basically is just going back to Project Server 2010. And we can do that because of the way Microsoft designed this upgrade process. You're not doing an in-place upgrade. You're setting up new servers. All your all the upgrade stuff is occurring against copies of the databases. So you're not doing anything destructive, hopefully, to those original databases. And since you're in a read-only mode, you know, no changes are going on while you're doing your upgrade. So you can always fall back to that Project Server 2010 environment if you have to, which, you know, that's a pretty rare scenario. Then when it comes to our upgrade, most important thing is backups, of course. And this is where you work with your DBA and all the other team members that you need to work with to make sure you have everything you need just in case. And so what we did, once we communicated what the upgrade process was going to be, we had a window. So I think we started on a Friday morning, and we planned to go live the next Monday. So that Friday morning, you know, we send out the communication that blah, 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 it's happening starting now. We switch it to read-only mode, and then we take a whole bunch of backups to those databases, even though we're taking probably nightly backups and stuff, but we'll take a bunch of backups. Our database administrator will take those backups and restore them to our new SQL box, and then I'll be able to start my process, which can take a while. I don't think we have the biggest environment, but it's big enough that it takes maybe a good 9 or 10 hours to do the whole process. And a lot of this is you fire off a PowerShell command, and then you sit there and wait, and you watch logs, and you make sure it doesn't fail on you. And you shouldn't expect it to, assuming that you went through all the test upgrades and took note of any issues that you ran into. But for us, I think when we did our project sites upgrade, we have maybe 500 or 600 different project sites. It took about 7 or 8 hours. And then when you do those sites, there's a bunch of other steps you do. And then we do the UMT upgrade from what we were running, which was Essentials, to UMT 360. And that was about another hour or so upgrade. And the entire time you have to check logs, because even though you did this a bunch of times in your test environments, it's always possible that something could go wrong. And then afterward, you have to refer to your notes and migrate everything else that needs to be migrated. So if you have any custom settings, any custom fields, anything, you need to look at that and make sure it's in the new environment. And that also includes workflow. So we, after we got everything upgraded and connected workflow to the new project web access, or the PWA page, Dan and I worked to recreate all that workflow that was in 2010 using SharePoint Designer in 2013, published that workflow, and then did what comes next, which is basically a ton of testing.
Did you have to reset security?
No. Security came across fairly clean. The biggest thing was getting the workflows reset up, and then we had to restart all the workflow and all the projects and move them to the right stage. So that was probably the, I mean, Aaron did a whole lot of work, and he's paranoid, and I really appreciate that. but that was probably the biggest headache for me, is getting all the projects back to the right stage in their workflows.
Yeah, Microsoft has a good couple of steps to do, like pre-upgrade and post-upgrade. And one of those was like checking in projects and stuff. And then afterward, you know, how to republish and do your workflow and get them to the right stage. And I think UMT provided a lot of good information too.
Yeah, the UMT upgrade itself worked very well for us. All the data came across. So people were worried about the financial data. Am I going to lose all my financial data? No, that all came across really cleanly. The only thing that caught us by surprise, any UMT users in here? Yeah. The only thing that caught us by, the UMT folks. The only thing that caught us by surprise a little bit was They have a different CAL model, which is good, but I didn't realize that if I had a new user, new project manager, for example, they wouldn't automatically get the CAL to see budget information. And so they would come up to me, you know, after the fact and say, hey, I can't see my budget information. I said, well, you get the same security as everybody else. And then I finally noodled around and, oh, they don't have a UMT CAL assigned to them anymore. So I had to go in and manually assign those to the new people, but existing folks were fine.
The other thing about permissions, too, is that, I don't know if you're familiar with SharePoint permissions versus Project Server. So it detected what we were doing, right, and it kept us in Project Server permissions mode, so we didn't have to do any of those tweaks. And we wanted to stay in Project Server permissions mode. Just that's what we were familiar with, and it worked really well for us.
So. Yeah, yes. We don't specifically use RBS, but all of our other custom fields came across with the data, so I would be shocked if RBS didn't come across also. Yep.
Yeah, so after we test everything, and testing involves, you know, like workflow, like we're talking about, checking security, custom fields. We also want to do publishes, you know, make sure your project publishes, make sure the site gets created with the template that you have in there. Basically, just make sure everything that should work correctly is working correctly, and everything that worked correctly in your test upgrades is still working correctly in this one. And then we release to users in our communication. This is where we include that new URL and say, now you can go into the environment and it's live. But you always have to remember that something will always probably break. And what I mean break, not like everything is going to go down. For our environment, it was more like we're going to run into some bugs that we might not have seen before. And we did. We had a couple different bugs. We'll talk a little bit about those at the end, but one was with workflow. One was with a required field. So there's always something that you might run into, usually not showstoppers. If they're showstoppers, you hopefully would have run into them in your test upgrades. But because I'm paranoid, once we release it to users, I have ULS Viewer up, and I'm just looking at the logs constantly, and I'm watching performance because I want to be on the lookout for any weird performance or CPU spikes or any memory spikes, something that could be detrimental to the end user experience. So you basically want to keep that around. And then I think the last thing I have to talk about is test environments are crucial in this whole process. You pretty much want to keep your test environment around, or you want to get rid of it and build a new one. And what we do, we have three environments. So we have a test environment that's basically a clone of our production environment. The data is not exactly the same, but if we want it to be the same, it's really easy to do a refresh, especially now with the small number of databases for everything. And then it's a really good idea to have a third environment, which can be your development environment. For my purposes, it's when a new cumulative update comes out. I want to apply it not to the test environment because I'm kind of keeping that in the same level as production until we maybe schedule the upgrade. But I'll be able to test it on this dev environment that I can completely trash and rebuild really easily and make sure that maybe whatever bug it's supposed to fix is actually fixed and stuff. And then once you get approval to do it in your production environment, then you could do it in your test environment and kind of keep those dates of installation pretty close so you don't ever have too much of a difference between those two environments.
Yeah.
Well, I think Dan found out that there really is no easy way to do like an export or import. So it's kind of basically creating them from scratch in SharePoint Designer. So you'd have your one that you have set up in staging, and you'd redo that one exactly the same way and then publish it to your production environment.
I thought I was going to be able to export it to Visio and re-import it in, but it wanted to re-import it into the same environment. It wouldn't let me do it to a different environment or with a different name or anything. So unless I didn't understand it fully, which is entirely possible, I had to recreate them. Yeah.
And it could be an issue. I mean, we don't have a large number of workflow, but they're big enough that recreating them is...
It's just tedious, right?
Yeah.
I mean, going through each one of them and doing them again. I got really good at it at the end of this process.
So, and that's pretty much what I have for the upgrade process. So, if anybody has any other questions?
Have you noticed anything else in the reporting?
We had to redesign all of our reports. Well, not redesign, but we had to re-verify all of our reports because the reporting database, I think, is similar, but it's different enough that you want to make sure you check all your reports.
And then,
Yeah, I'm pretty sure Rachel had to go and do that, right?
Yeah, we have a database administrator that handles a lot of these reports, and she had to tweak a little bit for the on the project side, and then on the UMT side, because they also consolidated their databases. They provided a nice, there's a nice guide they have that lists all the different fields for reporting and what you should be looking at. So there was a little bit of work that was needed to be done, but nothing too crazy.
Yeah, because the mainly database consolidations really kind of changed the way it looks. But she was able to do it fairly quickly, so I don't think it was too much of a headache for her. Sure. Yes. So you're familiar with enterprise project types? Okay. So that's kind of the base thing. So you define an enterprise project type, and so you could say enterprise project type for IT AV project, enterprise project type for IT upgrade. And with each different enterprise project type, you can associate a workflow to it and a custom template to it. So we can do that. So we have our facilities department and our architect's office, who does the capital construction projects. They each have their own enterprise project type, and so they have a different looking project template and a project site as well. So this is a little bit about our workflow. It's easy to set up in SharePoint Designer, so I'm not a developer, I'm not a coder, but I could figure this out. And actually, UMT has a tool for those using it in 2010 that does a GUI for workflow, and it worked really well as well. But I think this is probably a little better. It has a few limitations, but it has more options for email notifications, and you can use the workflow in other SharePoint environments. I just came out of a session where they're talking about using the workflow to archive off projects and that sort of stuff. So once you start understanding how to set up workflows, it's going to translate to other SharePoint environments as well. So I think that's really powerful. One thing that I had to learn is this step right here, which I'm sure you can't read from anywhere in the room except here. If Project Web App starts the workflow normally or restarts the workflow and includes this stage, that's a command in the workflow settings. But that was really, really important if you want to use, you know, the change workflow in the administrator side where you want to skip from stage 1 to stage 8, for example. If you don't have that statement in there, it's going to assign a task and wait for approval of that task. It won't skip a stage. So make sure you use that command and surround that within all the steps you want to skip, so it will jump from stage 1 to stage 3, for example. So that was my first hang up. The UMT folks, I called UMT support and saying, hey, I don't think something's working quite right. And they go, well, you know, workflow is really not our bag anymore. But let me tell you what the answer is. So UMT support was great through this whole process, and they even answered questions they weren't supposed to. So this is a copy or a visualization of our workflow. So it looks fairly complex, but it really isn't. So we start a new project, we go to stage 1, and that's where the project manager goes out and scopes out the project. They figure out, you know, what are they trying to do, what are the deliverables, how much it's going to cost from a high level. It then goes to stage 2, which is departmental approval. So in IT, it's me. For facilities, it's somebody else. For the architect's office, it's yet somebody else. And the little email icons you see up there, that means it shoots out an email and tells that person they're going to have a task ready for them to go and approve this project to send to the next gate. The next one is stage 5. And this little doohickey has a way to do this. Yeah. Look at that. Stage 5 is right here. Nope. Right there. That's where the budget office approves it. So the budget office can do one of three things. They can approve it immediately and jump it over to stage 7, which is right here, or they can put it down here to stage 6, which is portfolio selection, where it stays until we go through our capital selection process, or they can kick it back down here and says, you don't have enough information. I can't make a judgment on this. Give me some more information. Once it's approved, however it gets approved, it goes down here to stage 8 for setup accounts, and that's where I should back up, in the upper section there, we do a budget based on fiscal year. So we have 50,000 one fiscal year, and if it's a multi-fiscal year project, maybe it's another 80,000 the next fiscal year. When it goes to setup accounts, that's where we say the project's approved, Now do the work and tell me what the monthly spend rate is going to be on that project. So within UMT, we have the settings set up that you edit at the monthly level at that point. It goes back to the budget office for them to approve it at that point there. The next stage is waiting for a PM to be assigned. We may or may not have a PM at that second to put on the project, so that's just kind of a holding gate. And then it goes to manage. And manage is where we execute the project, and that's where we expose the cost forecasting as well as the tracking of actuals. And then it goes through our closure process, so when the project manager is ready to close it, they submit it to the next stage. It goes again to me in the case of IT, and I say, is the project manager says, yeah, I'm ready to close it because the work is done, or we've killed the project, whatever the case. If I agree, it then goes to closure activities. This is where we collect all the final invoices. We do lessons learned meeting. We turn it over to operations, all that sort of stuff. And then it's moved to financial closure. And in financial closure, it's where finance says, any unused money in the account, we're going to scoop it back, and we're done with this project. So once it goes to that financial closure step here, IT doesn't have any more to deal with it. And then finance will actually move it into the final closure stage. So any questions on workflow? This is, for those on 2007, this is why you want to get off of 2007, right? You can have all this information inside Project Server. So the name of the project, the executive summary, the university need, read that business need, the requested deliverables, the what else? The ROI, if you have any ROI, that sort of stuff. You can see on the left-hand side over here. Yeah, there we go. I'm on a summary page there. The financial detail pages is next, categories, budget, strategic impact, and schedule. So those are the things that the different pages we have. So I've now just arrowed down to the financial details. You see our funding source category. If we have a CIP account, we put it in there. Otherwise, if it's coming from a department, we put the department account in there. So not all that stuff needs to be filled in, but some of it will be filled in for some of them are required fields, like the one with the asterisks. Oops, I'm sorry. This is the budget. And so this is the UMT 360 budget web part. And so you can see it's a seamless integration in with Project Server. So you can't tell when you're using Project Server functionality and you're using UMT functionality, which is good from an end user perspective. And you can see that we've got the budget cost in here for those different months of that fiscal year. And this is, I'm showing up there in the drop down that we see that little carrot up there at the very top where it's pointed to years. That is telling you that's how you need to edit that budget information in the years category. And then when we move it to that next workflow stage and down in 8, that's when we shift the months, and that carrot will drop down to the months, and that tells the project manager that's what they need to edit on. They can view this in any of those areas. They can view the entire project. They can view it by years, semesters, quarters, months, but they can only edit where that carrot's located. This is an example of our PWA site, and these are active projects. So this is another case of making heavy use of views within Project Server. So I got this group by project manager and the workflow stage they're in. So in Laura's case here, she has 3 projects she's managing that's in department review. So she's scoping them out, collecting information about them, that sort of stuff. One is waiting for departmental approval. So that's the one I need to go in and check it out and do. She's got 6 in manage. And then she's got many in financial closure where she's done. So you can see the budget information is there. That it either has budget information or it doesn't. Depending on if it's a no-cost upgrade for us, we don't charge back resources. But this is the poor man's demand management tool. So I can see Laura is fairly heavily loaded there with that many projects in manage and department review. So if a new project comes along, I'm probably going to try to find somebody else instead of her to give it to. So this really helps me see what all the project managers are up to at a glance. SQL reporting services. As was questioned before, we do use this for different reporting. We have project data listings we use for our capital selection process. They get those out there. We've generated a form we need to fill out for generating a capital project improvement account. So we drag that information on our project server and make a PDF form that people can sign on their computer. So we go paperless on that. And so we do make pretty good use of SQL reporting services for our reporting environment. This is an example of some of the reports for the capital selection process. So excuse me, we have project ID, project name, what department's managing the project, who's requesting, what stage the project's in, and then the budget forecasting, budget or forecast for the different fiscal years, 13, 14, 15, and on out, whenever it's carried for. So the budget stuff wouldn't be possible without the UMT add-in. So in our longer view of what we really want to do instead of this double entry stuff, we want to have the project server budgets flow over to Oracle eBusiness Suite automatically once the project's approved. We then want to get information back from Oracle, the actuals, and plug those in the project server, because we always think we'll be doing our forecasting out of project server, because the Oracle really doesn't have that capability without a different projects module, which is, in the Oracle's world, is extremely expensive, even for higher ed. So we really make heavy use of project server for the project budgeting forecast and that sort of information. And finance makes good use of that. Yeah, you bet. Yeah, that's a good question. Let me see if I can jump back to my budget slide. Yeah, here. So, in UMT, the budget can be totally separated from project schedule, or it can be integrated in with the project schedule. We run it totally separated. So you can see that we have capital expenses, and if you would scroll down, we have operational expenses, okay? So capital expenses, one-time cost are systems hardware, software licensing, implementation, network hardware, yada, yada, yada. You can define those yourself. So whatever categories you want to track in, that's what you can track in. And so we set that up ourselves, and you say, in this particular month, we were going to spend $79,000 in network hardware and $39,000 in miscellaneous hardware and then some other stuff that rolls up to $124,000 for that month. Yep. Yeah, we don't use that at all. Now, you can. And for me, correct me if I'm wrong, you can integrate that information from project and flow it into this. So that's certainly possible. Where we started from, a lot of times when we do these estimates, we don't have a project schedule to go to, right? But at some point in the future, we could, and then we could integrate in and pull that information in. And you can control that by what stage you're in the workflow, whether you want to take it in isolation like this or whether you want to use project information and bring it in. Make sense? We use timesheets for reporting hours on a task, but not for, hours worked. That's all we do. Right? Absolutely. I kind of mentioned before that we had Architect's Office and Facilities come on board about 2 years ago, and then the finance department kind of directed that to happen because they wanted one view of all the capital projects at the university level. And we were able to do that this year. So when we ran the portfolio analysis this year, all the stuff was in there, including stuff that aren't really projects, but they were capital expenditures, like books and periodicals, replacing cars for the local public safety folks. So all that stuff was in there. And so he could run a report out of project server and get all the capital expenditures. We could rank all the projects using portfolio selection, which we did. So, yeah, all the stuff's in there. So here's some of the things we've uncovered during our upgrade process. I think the most issues we've had were with our custom templates in our project sites. So notebooks do not light up automatically. So if you want to use that notebook feature, every time I create a new project, I got to go into that project site and toggle it off and on. And once you do that, it works fine. So I don't know if that's a bug. I don't know. Did we file one on that? Do you remember?
I don't think we filed a bug on that, but we only decided to enable it for active projects,
right?
I guess. I mean, it would be pretty easy to use some PowerShell to go through every single site and enable that, but you know, since it would be a lot of old ones that wouldn't be used, we just decided to do it on a site-by-site.
But every new site I create, I got to go in and do that. It's a little bit of a pain in the ass when that's too much. And for us, the deliverables web part does not look correct until I delete it and then re-add it. Now, it looks, you know, it's funny. It looks right. When I built a custom template, it looks right on the custom template. But once I use the custom template with a new project, that's when these things happen. We also had an issue of changing email recipients in the workflow. When we first set up the workflow and we tried to change who the, if, you know, I first set up a test workflow and sent all the things to me. And then I had to set up another workflow. And I did the same thing in production just to make sure it worked. And then I wanted to change it to something else. And I had an issue with that. And so what I did was blow away the workflow, set up again with the right people in it. I don't know if that's been fixed yet or not because I've been scared to touch it because it's working right.
Yeah, that's when we opened a case. We opened up a case with Microsoft for that one. And I think we just did the workaround ourselves, you know, before they could solve it. And we were, you know, we needed to get going. So we did that.
There's some questions? Yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and I think now they actually added that to their recommended post-upgrade steps. So there's a couple things we had to do. I think we had to publish a lot of the sites. And then they recommend you also do the bulk update. And that's specifically to fix the risks and issues lists. Mm-hmm. I don't think we actually had those issues, but you do it anyway because it's one of those recommended things.
Yeah, I don't think it would fix the notebook issue that we saw. It might, but I don't think it would. Default workflow task list did not work. Aaron, you want to comment on that one?
That was another one. We opened up a case with Microsoft on this one. And basically what happens is, out of the box, there's this task list called Project Server Workflow Task List. And when you do the upgrade, you know, that's the default task list. And all your workflows are going to point to that one by default. I can't remember the specifics anymore since this was a while ago. But basically, no workflows would work. You wouldn't be able to switch between stages of the workflows. You'd get it started. I think you'd get your approval task maybe, but then you'd get this horrible looking error in the project interface and not much helpful in the logs. And so we opened a case on that with Microsoft. And the workaround for this one, and this may be solved in a future cumulative update, I'm not sure, but the workaround for this one was simply making a new workflow task list.
And then it worked fine.
A simple little step in SharePoint Designer. We didn't lose any functionality unless you know you want to refer to this old task list for whatever reason, but it was a strange one, and it tripped us up for a little while in all of our testing, but when the workaround was just to create a new list, that was acceptable to us because we needed to keep moving.
And the last one we came across was if you're using required fields with workflow, at least in our environment, in the 2010 environment, if there was a required field, you could go in and enter information and save, and when you had all the information, then you could submit to the next workflow stage. In 2013, you enter information, try to save, and it says no, required fields are all populated. So it was not checking to see if you're trying to advance the workflow, it was checking to see if all required fields were inputted before you saved. And that's really not optimum because all the information we have is filled in over time, and you don't want somebody not to be able to input something when they know it and save it and then come back to it later and finish it up. And so we opened a case with Microsoft. They did say, they finally had said, it's an issue, a bug, and we got an email from them last week.
It was a pretty long process. I mean, we opened up this case last year, and it takes a while because they have to, you know, they have to consider this because it's a design change request. According to them, when we submitted this, issue, it was by design, right? So they didn't really understand why we want to fix it or why we want to change it. But you just push them a little bit. And eventually, they asked for a demo. So we showed them what it was doing and what it should be doing. And I think the big thing is that the text, when you're setting this up, there's no difference in the text between Project Server 2010 and 2013. So it intimates that the behavior should be exactly the same.
Right.
So eventually they submitted it to their product team, and we heard, I think, last week that it was accepted. So they're targeting the April cumulative update for this to be patched in, which is pretty cool.
Right. Yeah. We don't have any role customizations in, I mean, I would term it more configuration in our project sites. We don't really have any customizations in it, so it's all, you know, we're adding separate lists and document libraries and that sort of stuff, but nothing too advanced. I can show you that later if you'd like to see it. It's fairly straightforward. So some of our challenges, other departments, adopting to a PM methodology. I mentioned we brought on the architect's office and facilities. In some cases, they're just doing a one-line entry so they can get all this other data in, including budget data, which is really what finance wants. But they're not really using the scheduling part of the engine. But that's okay. We all have to start somewhere. And that at least lets us to get all the capital stuff in there, and so we can go through and perform that capital selection process. And I kind of mentioned earlier, this year we got over the hump. We've established a committee. We redefined our drivers to align with our new strategic plan. We prioritized our drivers. We ran the portfolio selection tool. We used that output to do our capital selection process. And that's through that committee. Now it's going to the approval committee probably next week. So we're really excited that we've finally gotten that far. And I think everybody's been very pleased with the process. It's certainly not perfect, but it's much better than what we had before. So, any other questions? Yes?
Once UMT has an online version of stuff, do you guys consider going to the
online? Any Microsoft folks in here? So, probably because, we are recording, yeah. So, probably because of what I heard today. And this is the carrot and stick, I think, from Microsoft in some ways. Is I've noticed on the online environments, there were, when you saw demos for the online environments, they had three little triple dots right here, and you could click on it, and there were other navigation options, including getting to the project site. Right now, to get to the project site, you either have to go over, if you have something on the project site, like documents or issues, you can click here and get to it. Otherwise, you got to open up the project and click and get to it, which is sort of a pain. And that little navigation shortcut, I said, oh, that'd be really nice. When are we going to get that on the on-prem version? And the answer I heard was not encouraging. They said, well, the next major upgrade. I said, do you mean like Service Pack 1? He goes, no, I mean like Project Server 16. And I'm going, what, a year? And he goes, yeah, about. But it's available now in the tenant, right, if you're online. So getting some of those nice features, I think, are going to be much quicker in the online versions than on the on-prem version. So. Yeah.
Yeah, it's going to take a lot of pressure off of me.
Right. Right.
Yep.
Right. Right.
And they're implementing that new stuff so quickly in Project Online and SharePoint Online. Like, I saw a blog a little bit ago that they're already finding 16, you know, in some of the paths. So they're already on whatever their next major version is there. And it's just all mostly seamless to people, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, and when I talked to the Microsoft reps today, they said they were going to pressure UMT. But no, what they really said was it's really their fault because they haven't exposed some of the APIs that UMT needs to do this stuff in the cloud services yet. So, but I'm sure that's coming. Yes? I think the workflow makes me happier. From a project manager perspective, Kurt's one of our PMs. You know, the clients I think's better, the reporting in the clients better. I don't think it's a dramatic change. It's not like going from 7 to 10. You know, it's not that big of a lift. I think there are enough nice things that, especially if you're on software assurance where you don't have to buy it again, I think it's a good upgrade. And certainly if you're on 7, I would probably consider going straight to 13 instead of going through 10 if you can. Or at least, you know, when you expose it to the users, you may have to do that first step behind the scenes and then go to 13, right? So we're certainly not disappointed. I think the workflow probably makes it worth it for us, along with the other things Aaron mentioned earlier. The OneNote notebooks. I was really disappointed when the meeting workspaces were going away because we made pretty heavy use of them, but I've changed my mind with the OneNote notebooks. They're really pretty cool. And I have one more final slide to wrap up. Just trying to see if we've said... Yeah, the last bullet is probably one of the more important ones, you know. No tool is a magic silver bullet. It's more of a cultural change. It's more of a challenge than the technology change. It's always the case. So let me jump out of that, and I think, yeah, I have a decent wireless, so let me jump over here. So this is our live production environment. Hey, look, it's still up, Aaron.
Yes, this part makes me nervous.
And so this is the view I showed before. I'll go down to Jeff's project.
I need to put it on the screen here.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, there we go. So I'll go down to Jeff's project. He's got the Oracle stuff here in Manage. So there's the Oracle eBusiness Suite upgrade. I can jump straight to it, the site, by clicking over here. At least I should be able to. And there's all the issues we talked about that he's got going on. But we make heavy use of this, and what I wanted to show is the OneNote. So if we go to the OneNote thing, it opens up OneNote and web app. So anybody with a compatible browser, which includes Chrome, Firefox, Safari, IE, is going to be able to see his OneNote stuff. And so there he has the project team meeting, who all the attendees were, and probably the agenda on here. Yeah, there we go. When I use it, I usually like to use it in the Thick client. And so when you open it up, down here is my Oracle eBusiness Suite upgrade notebook. So I'll look at it in this view, which is better for me. And you got the different tabs. He's got one for project team meeting, his Monday morning meetings, his communication working group meetings, PM group meetings, on and on and on. And you can see each of the meetings has a session down here with the date associated with it. And so if we want to go back and see what we talked about at a particular meeting, we can do that. So this is what we used to do in the meeting workspaces. And once we figured out what we could do here, we thought this was even more powerful than the meeting workspaces. And so we make really heavy use of OneNote and these project site templates. And that's why it was a little disappointing that they didn't light up automatically. But to light them up, if I go back a level, so if we go through here, site settings, manage site features, you scroll to the near the bottom notebook.
Yes,
site notebook right there. So all you, to make it work, all I have to do is deactivate and reactivate, and it works. I'm not going to do that to his because he'd be angry with me.
And there's a little bit of setup for this on the back end. Like if people are running, you know, the 2010 environment, web apps are built into SharePoint 2010, right? Is there anybody here on 2010 and using those? Well, it's pretty cool. But they made it look really nice and simple for users here. But on the back end, they actually split that product out into its own, you know, its own package now. So we have our project and SharePoint environment. But you also need another couple servers running Office web apps. And so when you click that notebook link, it's actually going out and talking to a completely different set of servers. And,
sorry.
But once it's set up, it's really seamless, and then it works with all the other Office documents here, too. And yeah, it allows you to do pretty much everything in the browser. And it's really full-featured, and they patch Office web apps just the same way they do project servers. So you'll get a cumulative update, you know, for December, and it'll have updates to Project Server, but there'll also be one for Office web apps, and that just, they continue to add features to those clients. So OneNote gets better and better and more on parity with the Thick client version.
And this timeline on the project site comes from the project manager when they're using the Thick client. If they build a timeline in the Thick client that you can do in 2013 and you publish, then that timeline it comes out here to the site. So it's really nice for team members to say, what's coming up in the next month? And you don't have to do the whole project. You can just do what specific things you want them to see at that point. So that's kind of a nice new feature as well. Any other questions?
Yes?
Except for publishing, yes.
We had, yeah, I think for the most part it was a lot faster, especially the queue. That was a lot faster for us, with a couple exceptions. The project he was showing you before, Oracle, that's a big, big project. And we had some issues with that in 2010, where it would take like 20 minutes or so to publish, sometimes more. And then there was a bit of a reporting issue with that. But after a particular cumulative update, it might have been October, we saw those times go down too.
Right.
So whatever bug that was still hanging around for some of these published times, they seemed to fix that in one of the cumulative updates. So publishes are a bit faster than they were when we first went to it. And then a lot of other queue jobs, like Active Directory syncs in particular, those are really fast now compared to before.
Yeah, there's not a dramatic increase in publishing times, or a decrease in publishing times, I should say. It's probably some, but I was hoping to see a better improvement in that area. But like Aaron said, the other areas, I think, are really fairly substantially faster. Other questions? Great. Don't want to stand between you and the party, so thank you very much. We appreciate your attention.